Welcome to the Hostile Zone.
Use your voice, somebody hears you.
Welcome to the Hostile Zone. You're with the infamous and dangerous and always in your face, calling a spade, pulling back that curtain on waste, fraud, abuse of government, and societal issues that matter to you, the taxpayer, and you, the American. Welcome to the Hostile Zone, where the truth is a weapon and silence is surrender. Tonight, we enter the battlefield of trauma. Not in theory, not a debate, real life trauma. The kind that shatters homes, scars children, and leaves families wondering if they can ever breathe again. This week, the world has reminded us yet again of its cruelty. In Minneapolis, Minnesota, bullets tore through a school and a house of prayer became a war zone. In California, the name Emmanuel Hara, a seven-month baby, went missing, is a symbol of innocence stolen before it even can speak. Trauma is not a headline. It's not a number. It's a wound that cuts deep into the flesh and into the memory and into your identity. But there is the truth. Some rise from the wreckage. Some refuse to stay broken. Some turn their scars into shields and fight forward. Our guest tonight is one of those warriors. Adrian Caldwell is the author of Unbroken, Life Outside the Lines. Her story is an amazing story, folks. Her story is forged in fire, abuse, poverty, homelessness, violence, loss. I could go on. We only have an hour, so I could keep going. But instead of surrender, Adrian built a life of purpose, a voice of truth, and a message of hope. This is not just a memoir or a Come Weep for Me book. It's a battlefield of testimony. It is proof that the broken lives can be rebuilt, that silence can be broken, and that even in the ashes, survivors can be unshaken. And tonight, her story marches into the front lines here on AM/FM, iHeartRadio, social media, and if it's not on your television, demand it. But I digress. Joining me, as always, is the elegant Storm in silhouette herself, my co-host, and the personification of unshakable grace under fire, Miss Bianca C, S-E-A, like the ocean.
Thank you, Bianca C, that's me. Hello, everyone.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Miss Bianca doesn't chase attention, she commands it. She doesn't follow trends, she sets them and puts them into tone. And when she speaks, elegance stops being soft and it becomes a strategy. Bianca, welcome to the battlefield. It's going to be quite a battle tonight.
Yeah, well, life is a battle.
Quite a story, folks. Quite a story. Very relevant to what's going on in the world right now. I'm very, very, I don't want to say excited because it's not an excited situation, but I'm happy. Here it is, folks.
Humble?
I'm humbled. Mm. Oh, you got me on point there. Not in the teleprompter or anything. That was right there. Real. That was real. Humbled that she is taking the time to talk to us and to express to our viewers and listeners what she's gone through and where she is today. But as always, we must start the show with the famous relevant quote of the day.
And what is the quote of the day?
Well, thank you. The quote, "The world breaks everyone, and afterward, many are strong at the broken places." The world breaks everyone, and afterward, many are strong at the broken places. Mm-hmm. Ernest Hemingway.
Oh.
Wow. All right. So let's get into it.
Good one.
Alice, let's bring in our guest, Adrian. Let's welcome her to the show.
Hi. Thank you both so much for having me. It's quite an honor to be here.
My name is.
My name is Adrienne Caldwell. I'm the author of Unbroken: Life Outside the Lines. It's the story of my life from early childhood to about early 20s. During this time, I was either the witness to or the victim of the sexual assault of a young girl, the drowning death of another child, emotional and physical abuse, extreme poverty, mental illness, homelessness, horrifically abusive foster care, bulimia, drug and alcohol addiction, pedophilia, death, suicide, and even incest.
Wow. You know, wow. I mean, we spoke previously, obviously I've read your stuff and spoke, but it is just shocking. And you look great. You sound great. You're doing great things. You are the definition. Like if I open the dictionary, which obviously probably half of our viewers and listeners don't even know what a dictionary is anymore because AI will do it for you. But if you open up a dictionary, a Webster's dictionary, you are the definition of resilience, truly, I think.
Thank you. I applaud you for that. Thank you very much. It has taken decades for me to get to where I am right now.
And you still suffer, I'm sure. There's no way you can totally put it behind you.
You're absolutely right.
So with that viewer and listener warning, there are some sensitive subjects that are going to be discussed. I don't want anybody who has been a victim of abuse or neglect or anything like that to be triggered. And I don't say that in a woke sense because we're not a woke show. Mm-hmm. I mean that it's because people who have, you know, there are certain things. If you have PTSD, I like to call it PTSS because it's not a disorder. Something created it. It's not a disorder. It's a syndrome. People that might suffer from post-traumatic stress, they might hear something or see something tonight that might trigger them. I want to warn you on that before we move forward. So segment one, we're going to talk about why the book was written. So I want to ask you, Adrienne, you carried the weight of abuse, neglect, and betrayal of our very own systems that were meant to protect you. To write this book, you had to reopen wounds that most people would rather bury and probably be embarrassed to even talk about. So why did you choose exposure over silence? And what responsibility do survivors have to tell that truth to others, kind of like a pay it forward? Big question. Break it out however you like.
So you're right. It took a lot of unpacking to get this book written. I was professional level at repressing emotions. I would put all of the trauma into metaphorical boxes that go on metaphorical shelves and go behind a metaphorical door. And I would just push everything down. And a little bit of back information. I was a ward of the state, Children's Protective Services intervened. My mother was schizophrenic, physically abusive.
At what age might I jump in that you got into this?
Sure. I was 12 years old.
Okay.
So after I got out around the age of 20, I requested my case files. And I had this giant box, two huge stacks of letters of papers, monthly reports, psych evaluations, clinical evaluations, the entire story on how I entered foster care, all of it. And I've had that box for 20 years sitting under my sofa. And I would periodically try to go through the documents, go through the papers. And I just couldn't. And right. I would put them back under the couch and just leave them there for a few more years. And about 4 years ago, I was finally able to open the box and start going through the papers. And what got to me the most, I had grown a lot. I had been able to forgive my mother. I recognized that she was schizophrenic. She was sick. It wasn't her fault. I realized with other people, they were in bad situations themselves. But the only person I've not been able to forgive was, I call her the witch from hell.
TB. Right, yes, with a B. Remove the W, okay?
Yeah, TBFH.
Yep.
And I wanted some sort of repercussion, some sort of action taken against her for what she did to me. My schizophrenic, physically abusive mother, I had never had a nightmare about her. But TBFH, I've had nightmares where I wake up crying as recently as a year ago. So I reached out to lawyers. I reached out to people in Children's Protective Services. I reached out to every connection that I could possibly find. And I kept getting the same answer. It's too late for you to do anything. There's nothing you can do.
Wore up, right?
I'm sorry?
The statute of limitations wore past the time frame.
You're exactly
now,
right.
I don't know if you want to say what state this occurred in.
Texas.
Okay, because, you know, sometimes some states, and I'm not proclaiming to know Texas, but the timeline of statute of limitation actually does not begin, clock doesn't begin until you turn 18. Not the chop. So in other words, like if you were a victim of, obviously, what, you know, any of these things you said, your actual timeline would, for somebody, for the statute of limitation would be at 18, not at 13, at 12.
And people don't realize that.
And that plays a huge factor, especially in sexual assault cases and things like that.
Yeah. Well, for me, 18, it was a 2-year statute of limitation. All the lawyers said, there's nothing you can do. And so I did the only thing that I could do, and that was start writing. And I'm the type of person, growing up, I went to 13 different schools before I graduated high school. So I'm very good at meeting people and getting them to talk about themselves and keeping the spotlight always off of myself. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
You were guarded.
But the few people that I would open up to would always say, from the time I was 15 on, you should write a book. You should write a book. And so when I got nowhere with getting TBFH, well, first I wanted to make sure that she had no more foster girls.
And did you successfully accomplish that? Is she no longer, I don't want to say serving in the system, but within the system?
She no longer has a license in my county. And you can find anything nowadays. I found her new address and I made a report to the county that she presently lives in explaining what I went through. So I pray to God that she does not have access to foster children anymore. Because
I hope they heard you.
I hope that.
Yeah.
And this one, for you saying this right now, it's going to be out as well. So it's good that you do that. Adrian, I have, why tell your story now? Why today?
Well, honestly, I wasn't able to do it earlier. I did not have the emotional bandwidth. I had my daughter when I was 25. Prior to that, my life was one disaster after another. And I really did not have my stuff together. And when I had my daughter, she was born August 7th, I immediately started drinking again. And November 8th, I woke up on the bathroom floor mat. And that was the date that I decided that, because I was terrified to be a mother. And I was telling my husband to tell his parents to take her, that I wasn't able to raise her, take her back with them. They were from England. He was from England. Take her. I can't do this. November 8th, I would wake up hungover on the bathroom floor mat, and I decide that I am going to raise her, and I am going to do whatever it takes to give her a childhood that I didn't have. So what that meant for me was getting my life together. I ended up becoming a certified financial planner, senior financial advisor at a military financial services company. And really got my life together up until, and this will be in book two, at 35, I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. So my body rebelled, and I have lived through hell and pain for years. And I am only now in a position where I've been able to write. And I realize that had I been healthy, I would have stayed a financial advisor, and this opportunity would have never presented itself.
Isn't it crazy how, like, wow, you know, nature just does what it needs to do sometimes?
Yes, I feel like it, what happened was what needed to happen to put me in this place where I'm able to face what I've encountered and to have the time and the faculty to address it. So right. It's taken me.
You were probably very instrumental and understanding and helpful with the military personnel that you assisted with this unnamed financial government military institution. We don't want to do that, but you served them, and obviously you can relate to traumatic brain injury and PTSD that some of these people are going through. So that's good that you got that opportunity to work and do that.
Yeah. Absolutely. My grandfather, though he was schizophrenic and he was medically retired from the military, he served in the Navy. My cousin, who is like a brother to me, he was a Marine. I never served myself. My psychological background, I wouldn't have passed. But it was the most that I could do to help serve my country, to help serve those serving.
Well, knowing that financial institution and being using their services, I thank you because they've been extraordinary in helping me with all kinds of financial stuff. So they've been serving me for 20 years. So I thank you for that. Let's going to move into the, did you want to say anything extra? We're going to go into segment two.
Go into
all right. Segment two. All right. We're going to talk about turning pain into purpose. So pain can be like a poison, I guess, or it can be extremely purposeful. Yes. What is the exact turning point where you realize that things just weren't designed to break you, but would instead show the true resilience from within, and now you needed to give back?
Okay. My breaking point, and I'm going to be very candid here, my breaking point was a couple of years after I graduated from college, using the tuition waiver wards of the state. They're allowed to attend public universities without paying tuition and fees. Now they even cover room and board and all this stuff. Back when I was going through it.
It's a state institution. You came through their system. They have a duty to do that. So
they're effectively your parents. So. Yeah.
And what are they going to do? Drop you at the at 18 into the community with broken and emotionally broken and not financially ready? I mean, that would just be a travesty, which you know they've done. Mm-hmm. So thank God that people like you have been lucky enough, but I digress. Go ahead.
So I'm sorry. Please repeat. Get me back on track.
Basically, I read a lot there, and I just wanted to know, like, what was the big breaking point? Because obviously, some people get the pain and they realize that's it. I'm broken. And others say, no, I wasn't really meant to be broken. I was meant to get punched and take this pain and then use that as a tool to help others. What was that point when that happened for you?
My breaking point was my final suicide attempt, and I had multiple suicide attempts. First one at 15, when I was diagnosed with major depressive disorder. I came back to TBFH's house. I took my razor apart. I cut my wrists. When she looked at it, she didn't ask about me. She wasn't concerned about my well-being. Her response was, "You didn't even do it right. You're supposed to cut along the vein." That was her response to me.
Wow, that's Oh my God, that makes me mad.
Yeah. We could go into a lot more, but I used razors. I used pills. There's even one incident where I was in a complete drunken blackout where I downed a bottle of pills. I wanted the pain to stop so badly. I was so desperate that in a drunken blackout, I attempted to kill myself. And the next day I woke
up. I'm glad you weren't successful.
Well, that must be said for a reason again.
And I woke up in the hospital in a gown in bed, and my Aunt Rose, who I say God didn't give me a mother and a father, he gave me two mothers. She told me that I had overdosed. And I looked at her and I swore, I was like, no, I didn't. And they even showed me the toxicology report where I had downed a bottle of Xanax. And I still didn't believe it. And it wasn't until I got in my car that I saw the regurgitated, leftovers of the pills, which people don't realize your body will fight to stay alive.
To stay alive, right. Mm. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And that's when I finally accepted that, yes, even in a drunken blackout state, I was so desperate to end the hurt, to end the pain, that I tried to kill myself. Now, my final suicide attempt, I got my uncle's gun, a 9mm Glock. Wow. I put it to my forehead and I pulled the trigger and it went click.
Wow.
And I pulled the trigger again, click.
Two times?
Yeah, wow. I pulled the trigger twice.
Oh, that, if that isn't the finger of God telling you right here, this is where you need to be.
Yes.
Yeah, there's your answer.
Yeah.
That's very moving. And I'm
really,
you got me, you caught me on air because you didn't tell me that.
Wow,
you kind of pulled the wind out of us on that one. That's good though. I'm glad, and that's good that good thing we gave the viewer and listener warning.
Well, that makes me believe that you definitely have a purpose to let your message go out there. It's unbelievable. And Adrian, I have a question.
The safety had engaged by less than a millimeter. It was the breadth of a hair. A hair is all that had engaged.
Man,
and that saved me.
Even the and from that, the hairs on my arm, I'm like, that is just crazy.
And in the psych ward that evening, that's when I realized like almost a divine peace came over me.
Right.
And I knew that I had a purpose on this planet. Now, unfortunately, God doesn't send memos. He didn't tell me what that purpose was. But that was my moment of pain and desperation and intervention. So Bianca, you were going to ask me a question.
What helped you keep going when it felt easier to give up?
Well, I tried giving up repeatedly and I wasn't allowed to, whatever higher power you want to call it. It wasn't an option for me because I tried repeatedly and it never worked. So I came to the conclusion that my time on this planet would not be over until I had achieved my purpose, whatever that purpose was. And right now, I think it's having written my book, sharing my story. I believe that's my purpose, to give others hope and to inspire others. Anybody who's struggling or who has struggled in the past, to let them know that their situation is temporary. It's not always going to be that way. And to just invoke them and entreat them to take just a baby step, just one step forward, and then follow it by another and another. And ultimately, you will be out of that situation.
You said something key there, and I like what you said, and I want to reiterate it myself for the viewers and listeners.
you were able to tell yourself this is a situational time period issue. Not going to be the same tomorrow or the next day. People look at it, this, an incident that happened to them and say, it's forever made changes. And you have to look and say, yeah, this happened. It was terrible stuff. It really knocked you down, really hurt you, cost money, cost a lot of things. But 5 years, 10 years, maybe 10 days, it's a different place. And I like that. So I'm going to segue into the next section. If you were done with that, are you good? You can move forward.
Okay.
Good. Okay. Next one, I want to talk about trauma in the headlines, right? There was a school shooting recently. I mean, it's almost like this is almost an everyday occurrence, which is just terrible that we are the most advanced nation in the world. And we still are slaughtering our children. It's terrible. So I'm going to say, when children are slaughtered in the classrooms, we're not just witnessing a tragedy. We're witnessing a nation that is normalizing trauma. We're accepting trauma to be normal, and that is not normal. So what does it do to a society when schools become crime scenes? And what is the long-term cost when an entire generation is raised in fear over safety? Tough question. Think about it for a second, but I wanted to be impactful.
Well, I have a 20-year-old daughter myself. She does attend university. And I was recently sent a text message, every parent was, that there was an active shooter on campus. And thank God it was a false alarm. But just the fear within me, and my heart goes out to the parents of the children that had to suffer through this, whether they be actual victims or just witnesses. You know, the studies say that your brain can't really differentiate between being a victim and witnessing the trauma.
I actually agree, and I say, I'm, you know, for what it's worth, I almost say, is it better to have not experienced it and been the one that was killed compared to the one that's sitting next to the person that's killed? Maybe the person that was killed, adult child, we're not talking just in general, a person who does not have to wake up tomorrow and the next day, every day, replaying the image of the person next to them being slaughtered. I don't know. It's not the question. It's a thought out there. I just personally, I would rather be the one to be shot myself than to watch somebody else next to me.
Nobody
should ever have that experience. We shouldn't even have to talk about that. But it's kind of like a reality. You're a victim regardless.
Yeah.
And the mother at home and the father at home and everybody else that had to hear these notifications on the news and the text, like you said, everybody's a victim at that point.
But I know you.
I actually spoke to my daughter about it, and this is normalized for her. The active shooter alert, the fact that there could be a shooter on campus. She told me that even when she was in high school, they had drills, and that it felt like a very real possibility for her. And my heart goes out to her because she should not, at 20 years old, she should not be thinking about those things. That should be the last thing on her mind.
That should be not what you're thinking about ever in any situation.
I agree.
Obviously, we have war and things of that, you know, but you should never at any time be worrying that you're going to take a bullet or watch somebody else take a bullet. Or even the person that was stabbing people in Walmart, right? These incidents that occur. Nobody should ever have that fear.
That's true. Like I have to look like 360 all the way just to go shopping at Walmart, to be honest.
And, yeah.
You know, like every time I bring my child with me, you know, now I got to be worried if he'll be taken or, you know what I mean? So like, it's unbelievable. It's, you know, but you got to still go on.
Yeah.
That's it.
I would like to see, and I do a lot of research myself in writing like you, and I would like to see what is different about this generation that these shootings are just becoming so normalized. because really the first, and it's not in the notes that I was going to say, but really the first school real shooting took place on a university campus in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to name, I'm not going to give any names like that because I'm not going to, I don't want to give any notoriety, but
do your research. You're referring to UT Austin, correct?
Yeah.
The Bell shooting.
The Bell Tower shooting. That was really the first time we saw, not, I think the first time we really actually saw it. And then now it's like a regular thing. I don't know. It's crazy. Well, something's wrong. Something's wrong.
Adrian, I have another question. When schools aren't safe, how can kids and parents begin to heal?
God, Bianca, that is a fantastic question. And honestly, I don't know that I have an answer.
Because somebody wants to know that. Somebody wants, one of our viewers or listeners is feeling that, and they want to hear from somebody that's been through it like you. How do you deal with it?
Repeat the question for me, Bianca, please.
When schools aren't safe, how can kids and parents begin to heal?
And you're on the front lines. You've experienced things, so you're here.
I don't know that you do heal when you're still scared for your safety, for your well-being. I don't know that it can happen until you are in a safer place. Now, for me, it took decades before I was able to even put down roots and to begin to feel for decades, I felt like the rug was always going to get pulled out from under me, no matter what situation I was.
You know, failure. Right.
And my life proved me correct. You know, I've written one book, which goes up to early 20s, but the hits just came on coming. And so it's really only been recently, the last 5, 6, 7 years since I've married my husband, and he is the definition of stability, that I have felt safe, and it wasn't immediate with him. It took a lot of reassurance,
right.
But that pain had to heal first. At least it had to scab over. The wound had to scab over before I could start moving forward in a hopeful, positive manner, believing in myself and believing that something good could come from the world.
Right. So I want to ask a little small follow-up to that. And if you had one word, what would that word be that you would say to somebody who's in the audience listening or watching that will help them maybe make it to the next step? What would that word be that you would, that's impactful for you, that you maybe would share with somebody that may need that right now?
Okay. Give me a second to think about it. I want
to. It's a good question. And it just came to me. It was not pre-planned. I didn't try to drop it on you, but I think there's something for everybody, has something, you know, whether it be a religion thing or what, you know, everybody has something in your mind that is the focus word. You have to have some sort of focus word that got you here. And maybe that could be the word that somebody else needs.
I'm going to use a modifier.
Go for it.
Be brave.
Be brave. Right. And that is a very broad term because everybody, that's perfect. That's a great one. Because that could apply to everybody, anybody's situation. Yeah, I like it. And that's what we try to do on this show. Be the voice for the voiceless. Speak for those that can't speak for themselves. You're doing that right now. You're speaking for so many people that probably are feeling the same way that you've felt all your life, and they only wish to be where you are now, and you might be that guiding light that they see and say, hey, I can be there. Like you said before, it's temporary, situational. It's not a lifetime situation. So continuing with trauma in the headlines, baby Emmanuel Harrow, missing out of California. I shake my head, just terrible stuff. So with that, Emmanuel Harrow's name will be remembered as a baby destroyed by abuse before he even
had a voice. What does his death reveal about the cracks in our system, the very system you've been through? And how should a civilized first world country, we're not a third world country, a civilized first world nation measure itself when it cannot even protect its most innocent and most vulnerable?
I could not agree with you more. Little off topic from there, but when I was in sixth grade, my best friend convinced me to go to the counselors. Children's Protective Services were called. They came to my house. My mother could play normal. She could fool anyone. And if the caseworker had taken the time to either speak with my family or look at the prior incident, there was an incident from first grade where my mother had hit me so hard that it left a mark across my face for the day, then that caseworker would have realized that this wasn't just a typical mother-daughter disagreement, that this was ongoing trauma and abuse. And the trauma and the pain of losing a child, and it's unspeakable. It's horrific.
I can't even fathom the thought of it, to be honest with you. It's a terrible stuff.
And it terrifies
me. This conversation isn't opening any additional wounds for you. I hope that it's not. Again, we put the viewer warning and listener warning.
Right. Adrian, when we hear Emmanuel's name, it hurts. How do people ever feel safe again after a tragedy like that?
Because and just for a little backstory on the father who, well, the mother was charging this as well, but the father had a previous conviction, a felony conviction for child abuse. And the judge used their discretion as a judge and just gave straight probation and some mm-hmm. class about abuse. And now there's a dead baby. I just wanted to throw that in.
We need top down renovation. That's not the right word. We need top down restructuring. And I think it has to stop, has to start with the very top people, the people in charge. They have got to recognize that our system is failing our children, the most vulnerable people, our most vulnerable population.
It's our most cherished resource. Forget fossil fuels, forget oil, forget natural gas, forget tech. This is the future of our own people. Mm-hmm. It's our most valuable thing.
And it goes even beyond our children, our disabled, our mentally ill. We are failing these people repeatedly over and over. And the same, just like you said, the father had a felony conviction. He should have been nowhere near a child. He should have been in prison.
Right.
And the system is perpetuating the cycle of abuse by failing to stop it. Right. And I don't think it's going to take a genius to make those changes. I think it's going to take an investment.
Expensive, and we have to allocate public tax dollars away from illegal immigration and providing free stuff to everybody that is not a citizen here, that is not born to earn that right. It's our tax dollars need to go to these programs and systems that protect our most cherished resource.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Top down. We have to fund it. It has to be funded. We're spending money on far stupid things across the board and dropping the ball. It's terrible.
So when I was in foster care, I had a social worker. She had 30 plus kids. She was underpaid. She was making $36,000 a year or something like that. Now, granted, this is 1990, 1992, but that's not a lot of money.
Somebody with the education and the requirements to do this job.
Yeah, absolutely not. And they're not given the proper equipment.
A lot of states don't have the authority. Some states are county by county.
Now, I can speak for New Jersey because I worked in that system, and I know it very well inside and out. It's a statewide system. It has a law enforcement component. But you go to other states, it's a county social service thing with no law enforcement authority. And when you leave the county, you left the jurisdiction and they have to refer it.
Let me ask you, did they allow contracting of services?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. I think that's community services,
wraparound funds, funding.
I think that is a huge problem because you're creating gaps in oversight. The social worker is a state employee.
Right.
The TBFH, she was not an employee of the state.
They're not supposed to be making money. They're supposed to be getting expenses, money to be used for the child.
Well, that's a different conversation. It's a profession.
Right.
Becoming a foster parent is a profession for many, many people. Right. And they run as many kids as they possibly can through their homes. So I was in therapeutic foster care, which meant I needed a higher level of emotional support. I needed therapy. And that meant more money.
Right.
So she worked for them. They had very little oversight from the state.
And they're desperate for people to do this. So they almost put up with things that they shouldn't because they have nowhere to put children. And I've been in that experience on investigations where we had to order removal immediately of a child. And especially if there's medically sensitive, therapeutic mm-hmm. like you, things like that. Where do you put that child?
It's three o'clock in the morning
after a 911 call. And the child's beat up. Where do you bring them? So, yeah.
That's the problem. Yes, where, when I was with TBFH, the only other place for me to go was a girl's home.
I was going to say, also deinstitutionalized in America in the 80s. Everything prior to that was institutionalized. So, you know, orphanages no longer exist. There's no such thing as an orphanage anymore because that was a big institution with many, many, we kind of backed away from that. And then we ended up with this new system, like what you went through. And there is a lot of fallout in that. So it is tough. And I don't know. It's a really tough thing because is an institution better or a home better? Either way, you need a place to put this fragile being that we're charged to protect. They have to go somewhere and nobody's stepping forward to do it.
Yeah, I was homeless the summer after fourth grade. My mother, brother, and I spent the Houston summer downtown Houston with the skyscrapers. We stayed at the Salvation Army, and they would kick us out every day from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m.
And to work or something, right?
Yeah. To look for work. But in downtown Houston with your two children with you? We just wandered aimlessly, and it just...
Yeah, it's an amazement that society didn't abuse you further than you were being abused in the system while you were out during the day, and anything could have happened to you.
One time, somebody actually gave us a pizza. Somebody walked up to us and gave us a pizza, and it was one of the nicest gestures.
Right.
But my point in bringing that up was that I had already been in a homeless shelter. I knew what that looked like. And when I first went into foster care, I had to spend 2 days at a girl's shelter. Right. And I knew that I went with the devil I knew. You know, I stayed with TBFH. I couldn't complain or make complaints against her. I lived with her.
It would have been worse.
I would have made my situation worse for me. So I had zero recourse, and that's part of the problem.
Right. And, you know, I'm going to continue on with the broken system, and that's, I have a follow-up question for you with that, because I have strong feelings on this broken system as well. So you were failed by, clearly, the foster care system, failed by the mental health services that should have been part of that very system, failed by the very institutions sworn and taken an oath to protect you. So at what point does failure actually truly become a betrayal? And how do we, as Americans, as a society of adults,
reclaim that trust? How does the government reclaim that trust when the guardians of safety are the architects of the structure and trauma?
I have no trust in any government safety situation. It doesn't exist for me.
What's the saying? I'm here from the I'm from the government. I'm here to help. Oh boy, people freak out when they hear that saying.
My grandmother was my protector and my guardian against my schizophrenic abusive mother, and she died when I was 7 years old, and that's when my childhood ended. And I learned that the only person who was going to look out for me was me.
Yep.
And I got very good at working the bureaucracy and finding the loopholes.
There's a loophole in everything. Cut the red tape. I'm all for it. I'm with you. But you piss off a lot of people along the way, but you got to do what you got to do.
I sure did. My caseworker, when I was in, I received a congressional scholarship to do a 1 year foreign exchange to Germany. And I wrote my caseworkers explaining, you know, I'm very concerned when I come back. I don't know where I'm going to live. I don't know what high school I'm going to go to. I don't know how I'm going to get a driver's license. I listed all these concerns, and I waited a month or two. No response. I wrote her supervisor, 16 years old, and I went over her head. Good. And that's me. That's who I had to become.
You had to do that because no one else is doing it for you.
Exactly. I was the only one taking care of me.
So I'm going to digress that to what you said before. Be brave, be bold, and proactive. We'll add that to your statement before. Be brave and be bold and proactive. I thought I'd add that for you because I
think we could have that as a slogan.
I think that might be the part of the title of this episode. Be bold and be brave. I think they should. And I hope if you are out there and you are a victim of whatever age you're a victim, whether it's currently happening or previously happened, be brave, like Adrian said, but be bold and speak for yourself. And if you are not strong enough to speak for yourself, find somebody that is willing to help you speak for yourself, not to speak for you, but to help you speak for yourself. And I think as Americans and as human beings, we all are charged with that duty to assist with that. And that's why we're all here today.
Absolutely.
Ms. Bianca, you had some?
Yeah. Adrian, what's the first fix? If we could change one thing, what would it be?
Your broken system. What's your first piece? Good point. Tough one, right?
I think it would be as simple as doubling the social workers. Just to start. I mean, they can't.
Uniform training too. Uniform training, right? So everybody is on the same page.
Yes.
Uniformity.
And my book, as I mentioned before we started the show, I would like my book to be used in psychology and counseling programs that focus on early childhood trauma, because I've got the firsthand account. And then I have all of my CPS documents on my website available to view. So I've got the firsthand account. I've got the clinical account. Wow. And you can match the
two. That's powerful. And when the show, in the description for the episode and for Spotify and everywhere, all the links to get to your website and to buy your books will be available to everybody as well.
Thank you.
Moving forward to the next segment. The power of speaking out. So, Adrian, silence is the currency of abusers. Clearly, they benefit by your silence. It keeps the cycle, continuing to move fluidly without any stoppage. By writing and speaking, you broke the economy of silence. You were the doge of the victim. Do you believe every survivor has a moral duty, or let's say obligation, and to speak out? And to what price is paid when certain people are just continuously locked in fear in that cycle?
I don't think that the individual has a moral or psychological obligation to speak out,
right,
I think it would benefit them tremendously to do so. That goes back to
give them, because somebody's hearing you and listening to you or watching. Tell them why.
Because it allows you to take back some of your power. Of the power that when you're silent, the other person has your power. Right. When you speak your voice, when you speak your truth, you're reclaiming it. It's yours.
Right.
So.
Well, you've definitely reclaimed it, and you're showing resilience by doing what you're doing. And this is a very impactful episode, that's for sure. Miss Bianchi,
I know, it's taking it to heart.
Yeah,
right,
it's a very, very good episode, that's for sure.
I know.
And I know that you reached somebody today, guaranteed.
Guaranteed, yes. That's Adrian, many survivors stay quiet. What would you say to someone afraid to speak up?
Well, I understand the fear. When I was going through the foster care, when I was going through the system, I was terrified. My mother, when she found out that I was talking to social services, I mean, holy hell broke loose. But
especially when they let you down and then you go back to the abuser and they know that you ratted them out, the abuse is now worse than it was before.
Yes. Yes.
And many of the abused, I want to throw this in, many abused become abusers. And I know that that's something that probably rolls through your mind, and you're doing everything in your power to ensure that you don't do that. And that's why you're here.
Absolutely. Thank you. I made a very adamant point that the generational trauma that my grandparents passed down to their children, passed down to us, that I stopped and I did not pass it down to my daughter. Mental illness, for example, when she was 14 and told me that she was struggling with depression and anxiety, I took her seriously and I immediately got her a doctor's appointment and an evaluation. And she, about a year ago, she said, "Mom, thank you so much for doing that for me, because so many of my friends, they've needed help and their parents wouldn't listen to them, wouldn't help them." And to me, mental illness, it's a chemical imbalance in your brain.
Yeah.
And I compare it to a diabetic who needs insulin. Would anyone ever shame a diabetic for using insulin? No, of course not. And that's exactly.
Receptors and your serotonin receptors, if they're not operating properly, you're going to be consistently in a rut, in a whatever.
Adrian, you're really making me cry right now because, you know.
Well, then, you know, we're going to go.
You're being such a good mother.
I saw the tears coming down.
Recognizing to help your child. I mean, I don't know what else a good mother could be to recognize that and try to help your child.
We're going to move into our next segment.
Mother, I've been like extra sensitive now. So like when you become a mother, you understand even more.
Our next segment is going to be about hope and healing. So that maybe will help you. I was watching the tears from over here. And I'm like,
we
need to kick it back. That's why we did a viewer and listener warning. So hope and healing are truly real. And this is the uplifting section. It's the last segment before we have to close, close, because we're pushing really hard to the end. So I say
cried.
This to you.
I never cried on the show.
No, yeah, it's a first. I think that's good, though. I mean, it speaks volume that there it is, Adrian. You've done one thing. She's a mother, and you impacted one person already. So you've accomplished your mission before you even started. Moving forward. Yeah. Hope is not a slogan. It's a strategy and it's real. Your life is living proof that brokenness is not a destiny. For a person listening tonight who truly believes that they are beyond repair, what hard truth do you need to tell them? Do they need to hear
to know that healing truly is possible.
Give me a second. That's a tough one. That's a tough one.
It is a tough one. And I know it's not a sandbag question, but how do you answer it? It's tough. But there's something for you that you, I mean, at one point you said you knew it was situational. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. Healing is real.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. But it takes courage to confront the pain, because you can't heal until you've addressed the injury.
Right. Exactly. You have to address the underlying injury that created it. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
I applaud you for that. And Miss Bianca's got to jump in. We're getting close to a hard close, and I want to make sure that I get my closing in for you. And also, last statement on the hope. Folks, if you're listening or watching, make sure you go to the link and get her book, because that might help you facilitate the process for healing for yourself or for a loved one or a friend. Mm-hmm. Pay it forward. That's what I say. Miss Bianca. Again.
Yes. Adrian, you built the life, marriage, motherhood, a future. How did love and support help you stay unbroken?
Well, I was broken for a very long time. And it wasn't until the birth of my daughter that I decided that it was no longer an option for me to be
broken. End of the line, cycle broken.
Yes. And as I mentioned earlier, it wasn't an immediate decision. It wasn't, I have an attachment disorder from my early childhood, from losing caregivers. And I didn't bond with her immediately. And in one of the psych evals that you'll find on my website under the documents section, it says Adrian is terrified of having children because she's afraid that she's going to do to them what her mother did to her. So I'm sorry. Remind me again.
No, you were going there. You were there. Yeah, just keep going. You're going. You're basically just saying that there's hope and, you know, that you don't want to continue the cycle. Take it. You don't have to go script it on my work, on mm-hmm. my question. Just go what you're doing. But we are on a hard close. So you got about 30 seconds left.
Okay. I had to make a decision, and I made the decision to care for my daughter. And that meant stopping all of the self-destructive behaviors that I was engaging in. I was self-sabotaging. I was self-medicating. Right. And I had to take a stand with myself and demand better of myself.
And I'm sure late at night, even to this day, you have thoughts in your mind, not about what has happened to you, but are asking yourself, am I good at what I'm doing for my child? Am I good?
And
you from what we can see, you're doing it, and you're doing the right thing. You become somebody, you created something, and adversity sometimes creates advocacy. And that is you.
And I'm so glad that you're breaking the cycle, because it is hard. And I say thank you for breaking that cycle.
Thank you.
I want to give you 10 seconds before we come to, I have to go to my closing.
Mm-hmm.
Tell the folks about your book, when it's coming out, and then we're going to move you to the green room, and I'm going to close out.
Okay. Please visit my website, unbrokencaldwell.com. Sign up. It's just your name and your email. I'll send you the prologue in chapter one immediately. There are links in the email for you to pre-order. It says December 1. I'm changing that. The ebook and the audiobook will for sure be out October 7th. My publishing company and I are desperately working to get the print book out at the same time, but I can't promise that quite yet. But
I think the print book would be key, honestly.
Which would be
holding it in your hand. Key. Having a hard copy in somebody's hand, I think, will be impactful. Because it becomes a real thing like that. It's in your hand. Wow. Yeah.
I had a test drawn up. This is a paperback, but it has flaps like a hardback.
I like it. And I think it's in the hand. It's got images.
It's a great photo.
I wish you the best and hope that you can get the print out soon. I thank you truly from my bottom of my heart. And I'm sure, Ms. Bianca, you made an impact on our life today. And I know that there's viewers and listeners that you're going to help. Guaranteed. Thank you, Adrian, so much for coming to the show today. And stay in the green room. We'll chat after.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, thank you so much. All right, folks. So tonight, this was a tough one, right?
It was.
Are you okay now?
I didn't expect to cry on the show today. So
that's okay. I mean, it, we're humans.
But you know what? It really was a great show today. It really was. Yeah. It was very touching.
If you were affected by it,
yeah.
And you're not a victim of abuse or anything, then clearly somebody who has been or is currently will truly feel it even harder than you did. Okay, folks, tonight we marched with Adrian Caldwell through the fire. She is not just an author. She is just a survivor. She's better than a survivor. She's living proof that trauma does not have to be the final word. It is not the final step. And as to quote her, it is situational and temporary. You decide your fate. Her memoir, Unbroken.
Great title.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Her memoir, Unbroken, Life Outside the Lines, is more than a book, folks. It's more than a book. It's a battle testimony from the front line. It is a shield for the wounded. Buy her book. Feel her emotions come off that page. And maybe it'll blend with yours and help you get through what you need to get through or contact an advocate or somebody to help you. It's a torch for the lost, speaking for the unspoken. And it's a reminder that scars are not a sign of weakness. They are marks of a fighter who stood their ground and refused to surrender. But as Adrian Life inspires, the headlines demand our fury. In Minneapolis, children paid the price of bullets in classrooms meant to hold books and prayers. In this instance, since it was a Catholic school. In California, the name Emmanuel Harrow, a baby who never lived to see the first birthday. Just picture that in your mind. Never going to see his first birthday. Never did, never will. Will be a reminder of why innocence is destroyed and cruelty is winning. What are we going to do to fight back? Adrian's story is hope. Emmanuel's story is a warning that this could be your child next or the person next to you. One shows human spirit and the human resilience to fight through adversity and to seek positive change. The other shows that we cannot wait one more moment to look for it. We must act now. This is a war, not against one. It's against the abuser, not against one tragedy. It's against a failing system. Every silence, every indifference that lets trauma win is a loss for our society and our most cherished resource, children. I thank Adrian Caldwell because she rose from the wreckage and Emmanuel Harrow, unfortunately, never will. Sad moment. So let Adrian's resilience be your armor. Let Emmanuel's name be your battle flag and raise that flag high. And let them both remind you that surviving is not a weakness. It's a fight to win the war, not win the battle. And healing is not a tragedy. It's justice. And just leave one question with yourself. Can you look at yourself and say, you've done the right thing? With that, folks, as always, 180 forward, 180 backwards, 360 times 365, 360 degrees. 365 days a year, keep your head on a swivel because danger does not take a day off and neither should you. I thank you very much for coming to the Hostile Zone for yet
another episode, an extremely impactful episode. Miss Bianca, anything final?
I just like to say, you know, I hope this show has touched someone. Adrian would love that. And, you know, it's really a strong message, an unbroken person, and also be brave. That right. was a really good word, as she said. Be brave.
When
you
the
know
world,
what? I'm going to say that too. Be brave as well, because you know what? I'm taking that to heart too. Right. I'm going to be brave too, and I hope you be brave as well.
When a world shatters and healing doesn't seem like it's optional, it's essential. Thank you again, folks, for coming out to the Hostile Zone. Stay safe. Tune in. Check us out on every single podcast platform in 57 countries, as well as our AM, FM, iHeart, Radio, Spotify, etc., as well as social media. Thank you. God bless America, and good night.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight for the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, get through the night, that a flag was still there.
And she's not going anywhere.
Oh, say does that star-spangled banner